Welcome to the World of Horror Special Edition Quinnisode, Episode 110. I'm Christina.
And I'm Quinn.
This is the podcast where Quinn and I have a conversation about a work of classic horror in our Midwestern accents. For this Quinnisode, we are looking at Alfred Hitchcock's
1951 film, Strangers on a Train.
Disclaimers for adult language and heavy spoilers. Let's move on to our first segment, Christina and Quinn chat. Hi, Quinn. How's it going?
Hey, Christina. It's going okay. We've been having Quinn and Christina chat for a while today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. A lot.
Yeah.
It's like biblical weather. It's like every day the air is thick with humidity, and then it rains like a mofo, and especially at night, it's kind of spooky.
Yeah, and today it's so windy that my power was flickering earlier, which is crazy, because that doesn't usually happen around these parts, but the ground is, like, just so saturated, too.
And I see people outside, like, running and walking, and I'm like, well, God bless you, but I don't know if I'm going to go out to get struck by a lightning bolt.
Heck no. Because I just feel like, you feel like that's going to happen to you? Because I feel like that's going to happen to me.
Yeah, or a tree's going to fall on me or something.
Yeah. I think a lightning bolt for me.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the odds are pretty good that every one of us in our lifetime will be struck by a lightning bolt.
Aren't the odds even better if you've been struck once before that you will?
I heard. Again? I've heard that. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I want to believe. I believe that's true. Yeah. I don't know. Do you know anyone that's ever been struck by lightning?
I don't, but I bet you do.
No, I don't. I do know. Oh. Someone who's had a tree fall on them.
Oh. Did they die?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
I'm sorry.
So, what? I can't remember. Were you and I talking about, like, freaky deaths? Like knowing people who've, like, died in freakish ways? Like Final Destination style?
Or, yes, we were talking about people that got in accidents that were, like, crazy.
Oh yeah, like your ex-husband had a piece of metal go through his car window.
Yep. Yep, and it hit him in the shoulder.
That's super scary.
That is super scary. It just does not seem like something that could ever happen. Yeah, because I think we were talking about the that film that when we were doing A Clockwork Orange. Oh my God, brain fry. And the director died in a car accident, the Parallax View. Director died in a car accident and like a metal pole went through his windshield and hit him.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. And one of my parents, I don't know which one, because I just heard the story, but they were sitting in a recliner in their living room and a piece of the ceiling just like fell just as they were getting out of the recliner. So if they had remained sitting, then that could have been real nasty. But
So when I was younger, my dad had a brain tumor and it was benign, but it was huge, you know? So like it wasn't a cancerous mass, but it was so large that it was very dangerous. And it was pressing on different things that really, like, changed his personality in a lot of ways. When they found it and removed it, there was a very big chance that he wouldn't survive the surgery. And there was a 100% chance that he would lose one of his senses, like sight or hearing, and he lost his sense of smell. So the first thing, I mean, which is just all, has nothing to do with my story, but it just kind of, like, fleshes out the scenario for you. The first thing that we did, you know, the first time he left the house after coming back from the hospital from surgery was we went to a Toledo Mud Hens game and he was hit in the head with a bomb.
And he got a sense of smell back?
No. He had shaved his head. He had, the incision was from ear to ear across okay. his skull. Because, I mean, this was when I was 10 years old. So, I mean, like 30 years ago, I hope no one does the math. But, you know, so things were a little bit more archaic then. You know, I'm sure they probably could do something now where, like, they go in and, like, shrink it or blast it to bits and it comes out like in a needle hole. But then they like, they sliced his entire head, like ear to ear. So my dad looked like a, you know, completely crazy Frankenstein person. And, you know, he was not, his hair was growing back, but you could see the scar. I mean, it was, he was probably like 2 weeks from having surgery. And we go to this game, gets hit in the head. So, rushed him to the hospital where he had the surgery, which was in Toledo. He was fine, but woo.
I don't know if, you know, laparoscopic surgery has reached the brain, because I had a coworker, let me think, I was in my early 40s and I worked at this job, and this woman told me that she had to have brain surgery because she had this tumor. And I think it was the same kind of thing. It's like she could tell cognitively that things were changing. And up to this point, nothing had been different. So things were starting to change. And she had to, you know, go back to her doctor and tell the doctor that, yeah, I'm going to need this surgery. And she was looking for hair extensions so that when she came back, it wouldn't be too noticeable. So, but yeah, I remember thinking that is about the scariest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's really scary. And they, I mean, you know, they were able to figure out that it had been growing for years.
Yeah. Mm. I really hope nothing happens to either one of our brains.
I do too. I really, really do. But if it does, let's just vow not to go to a baseball game, right? Outing.
Okay. Fair enough. I think I can pretty easily agree to that.
Yeah, it's funny because the second place that we went, you know, after the hospital from the baseball game, it was like, you know, a week later or something, and our dog had died when my dad was in the hospital. You know, my brother and I were staying with my grandparents, and she was just so old and sick that they made the decision, you know, to put her out of her misery. And so my brother and my grandpa took her to the vet. I think, like, having that happen and my dad having been very sick and sort of sitting down and talking about the reality of the situation that he might not make it. You know, and then when he did, I think, I don't know why we decided this, but I mean, cause I was 10, so it wasn't my decision, but we decided that it was the right time to get a new dog, like pretty right away. We went to these people's houses who just had a litter of pugs, and it was just like this old man and woman and their pugs and this bird. And, I just remember being at their house, like, choosing puppy, or, you know, having the puppy choose you or whatever. The whole time, like, we're just sitting on the floor with these puppies. My dad is in the corner talking to the bird, and the bird is like talking to him and like trash talking him. And the bird was like, I think my dad first was like, "Hey, what's your name?" And the bird was like, "Why do you want to know? Why do you want to know? Why do you want to know?" And he was like, "I don't know. I just wanted to be polite."
Oh,
yeah,
that's sweet. Was that Jake?
That was Jake. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he was a good boy,
a very good boy, and I think he helped my dad heal a lot. Then my dad and him like went to walking school together, and we learned how to walk together.
Oh my gosh, amazing!
Yeah. I don't know if that was the right time to get a dog, but hey, it worked. I liked it.
Well, I'm sure Jake appreciated it.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Yeah. Yeah, dogs are great.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw something. I don't, you know, you see something online and it's like, is this really true or not? But it was just a little like TikTok or something like that. And the guy was saying that when we fall in love, you know, our brain chemistry changes and we get this like flood of endorphins and stuff like that. And, sidebar, when I was a kid, I kept saying endolphins because endolphins. But apparently every time you walk into a room, that's what happens to your dog. Your dog falls in love with you every time your dog sees you.
That like breaks my heart and gives me so much joy at the same time.
I don't know. It's so funny. It's like, I know cats and dogs are different, but sometimes my cat will just like lay on me really, really close to my face or like and put her paw in my face. And she's like chirping. She's purring so intensely.
Oh.
And so it does kind of seem like she's a little bit gaga for me.
Yeah, I love Rosie. Rosie's the best cat.
She's the best cat. I've had some good cats, but this one takes the cake.
Yeah, she's the best cat that I've ever met. And I have this weird sort of profound respect for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As you should.
Yeah, she demands it.
She's the queen.
She is the queen.
Of my very heart. All right, should we get into this movie, Quinn?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, we've been talking about this movie for, I don't know, 4 years now. That's not true. But this movie is called Strangers on a Train. It was directed by Alfred Hitchcock. The screenplay was by Raymond Chandler and Sesney Ormond. It was an adaptation by Whitfield Cook based on Strangers on a Train by Patricia Highsmith. And it stars Farley Granger, Ruth Roman, Robert Walker, Leo G. Carroll, and who's the chick who plays Miriam?
Oh, Casey something.
Also, Patricia Hitchcock appears in this movie, and thank goodness for that.
Oh, yeah, she's... I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to say she's my favorite part, but God, she's fucking amazing in it.
She's not in the book, so, I mean, she's just a definite addition to the movie. Cinematography was by Robert Burks. It was edited by William H. Ziegler. And it was released on June 30th. Ooh, that's almost coming up.
Yeah.
Okay, so the release date was June 30th, 1951, and it has a running time of 101 minutes. What is your history with this film, Quinn?
This is actually a Hitchcock that I don't have a very strong and thorough history with. This was just definitely, I saw it probably not when I was super young, probably after college, actually, I think. And it's not one that I watch a lot. And I don't know why that is, because it is so well done. And I do think it's very much not one that's talked about much.
I don't remember when I first saw this movie, and I watched it more this year probably than ever before, but I just, I think I'm hooked on this movie right now. I just really love it so much. It makes me feel really happy, and I like all the set pieces, and I just love the interaction between Farley Granger and Robert Walker, and it does make me feel sad to know that Walker died like less than a year after this movie. I'm so glad that he, I guess, was selected, you know, specifically by Hitchcock. Hitchcock just wanted him. And I think he was coming out of a rehab or had just recently come out of a rehab when they made the film. And then he went right back in. And then he died, you know, due to complications from his alcoholism. So it's very sad. But, you know, I'm glad that we got this performance.
Yeah, he reminds me a lot of Mitchum in this.
Mm-hmm.
He's so good. I wish it would have been great to see what he did. And it is so sad.
Yeah.
When he was 31, 32, it said he was 31 when he made this, which he does look a lot older, and he just seems to have this sort of, I don't know, otherworldly aura about him in terms of, like, he's lived such a life. Like, it just, you can tell. So I would have loved to have seen what he did. He was just so good in this.
Yeah, he really was. And I think the chemistry that he has with Granger is really good. I mean, I don't know if they had, you know, I don't know what kind of relationship they had on set, but I think that whatever it was, it comes across.
And, yeah, this one is so funny too. He and Granger, you know, I think are very comedic in this, but especially a lot of like the one-liners that he pulls off. And Patricia Hitchcock too, almost every scene she's in, she makes me laugh so much. I think she has this amazing comedic timing, but he is so funny in this. And this film is just so funny. And it's good to look at a Hitchcock film that's maybe like not supposed to be so serious and is supposed to be humorous, and to point that out, you know, and to like really, I don't know, draw your attention to that and like let yourself go, because this one is so funny and you can't ask for more in a film. I mean, it's such a suspense. It's thrilling. It's tight. There's nothing in it that doesn't need to be there. And it's also funny.
And also there's a lot of really cool camera tricks and things that Hitchcock pulled off that are just, you know, kind of unforgettable. I'm thinking of the lenses shot when Miriam is strangled, but I mean, he had a model, I guess, for the carousel. But basically, Quinn, what is this film about?
It's about two strangers that meet up on a train, and one is a younger sort of tennis star, and the other is just, I don't know, someone who wants to do something with his life. As he says a couple of times in the beginning, how he's envious of Guy because he's done something. He does something. And he kind of is coming off a little bit weird in the beginning. He knows who Guy is. He knows that he's this tennis star, and he knows his personal life too, that he is married, but wants to get a divorce and marry someone else who is a senator's daughter. He comes up with this idea. He's like kind of just scheming things. And he's like, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if like I killed your wife and then you just like kind of killed my dad? Wouldn't that be cool? And Farley Granger kind of leaves this experience and he's like, yeah, that'd be cool. You know, but not those words used, but basically like, okay, buddy. Yeah, sure, buddy. You know, walks away. And yeah, he does it. Bruno does it. He kills Miriam, who is Guy's wife, who he is attempting to divorce. She's pregnant with another man's child. He kills her and he comes back and he's like, well, I killed her, so you gotta kill daddy now. But he doesn't like his father. There's a scene, you know, in there where his father's like, we need to send him away. He needs to be contained, whatever. So he wants to get rid of his dad, and he sort of tries for the next, you know, the next part of the movie to convince Guy that this is like, he's got to fulfill this agreement, and draws him a map at one point. Guy goes, uses the map to warn his father that his son is crazy, and he gets to the bedroom and a cover comes off and it's freaking Bruno in his tuxedo. And he's like, I didn't think he'd do it. So anyways, by the end, there's this beautiful, you know, there's all these like amazing timing sequences. And then of course there's this beautiful tennis match at the end where it's a kind of a rush to the carnival where he killed Miriam before he gets there, because he's taken this lighter from Guy and he's like threatening to leave it places so that the police know that Guy, that they think that Guy killed Miriam, because he's obviously got a motive to do it. That was not a great explanation. I didn't do a really nice, succinct plot summary there. But in the end, there's this beautiful chase on the carousel, and the police do think that guy did it. But the carousel kind of goes nuts, goes like off its rails, and he ends up being very injured and dies from his injury and has the lighter in his hand. So then the police are like, oh, it wasn't you. It was him.
I mean, the last part is a little bit, if I had any quarrel with the movie, I think it would be the section where guy is playing tennis and he has to rush, you know, back to the place where Miriam was murdered so that he can retrieve the lighter, which actually isn't there. He's just been told it's there. And right. The police, I mean, they do think they are suspicious of guy. They don't really have anything specific that they can pin on him, but obviously he was in an unhappy marriage and he was somewhat publicly courting this other woman. And so he did have motive to kill Miriam. But it's also a case of mistaken identity because one of the carnival workers says to the police, that's the guy, meaning Bruno, but the police think that he means guy.
Yeah.
So, but there's also this whole section, like what is really explored in the book, and it gets a little tedious actually, is Anne, his girlfriend's suspicion of him as the killer. Because in the book, Bruno sends Guy lots of letters and saying, you know, sort of unspecifically implicating him in the murder of Miriam. And Anne she definitely should have suspected Guy, but of course she can't bring herself to believe that. But then she sort of does, but then she doesn't. And this goes on and on and on in the book. And in the movie, it's really badly handled. And I think that's down to the casting of Ruth Roman as Anne.
Yeah.
She literally was like a discount, you know.
She looks so much like Joan Crawford in this movie to me, like the height of Joan Crawford, that when I see her, I'm like, oh, but then it's not the connection isn't made because I don't feel like she was able to do her best.
I think she's pretty bad, but I mean, it's pretty clear how she was directed to me. You know, it's like, you know, maybe Hitchcock told her something to think about, you know, during this scene or whatever, but her eyes, you know, she's trying to do a lot of eye acting and it's pretty awkward.
Yeah, it is. And I think, like, I don't know if, I suppose, you know, I said that it was so tight and there's nothing here that doesn't need to be here. But I do think once you started talking, I also thought about sort of the tediousness of the tennis match, because it is so elongated that, like, when it first is starting to happen and he's winning, you're like, oh, good. But then it just goes on forever. And then, like, the bit about Barbara, you know, going and talking to the cabbie, getting the cab set up for him. And, like, it is really, it's almost like I think when I first watched this time around, I was like, wait, is he still fucking playing this game?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there are two tennis matches in this movie, and the first one is great because it's got the wonderful scene where everybody who's watching the match, their heads are turning as they're like watching each player across the net. But then Bruno's in the middle, smack in the middle, and he's not moving his head at all. He's just staring at Guy. Oh, so great.
You know, it's also scary when he is shot alone from a very far distance in front of the monument. Like, it really is this unsettling. It's so unsettling. And we also know that he had sort of plans to kill the president as well, you know, at one point.
Yeah.
And that's not really fleshed out other than his mom saying, like, do you still plan on that? And he's like, oh, no, what would the president think of that? You know, that's never, we don't hear any more of that. But that thought is, I think, in your mind. And when you see him in front of the monument, it's like, oh, God, it really is. It's powerful. And the scene, the tennis scene is too, when he's just staring. I don't know that there is a scarier scene. Like, if you ever felt like you were being followed or someone was watching you, like, that scene will resonate with you very easily.
Yeah, he's definitely, it's a sort of a combination of the acting and the directing, I think, because he it's unsettling. The character himself is unsettling, and we just get little bits and pieces. He says something, I can't remember what exactly he says to his mother, and she just pauses, and then she's like, oh, Bruno, like, you're a caution. But she's, you know, not sure how to deal with her son. And then the father, of course, thinks that he should be institutionalized because of his, or hit and runs, or I mean, something that he has a habit of doing that's extremely distressing. So this guy's not okay.
Yeah. And it just, so I, you know what I love about this is that, like, this movie, more than a lot of other films we've talked about recently, makes me absolutely think about what I would do in this situation. Because Hitchcock loves this. He loves the idea of, like, danger descending in a quiet place, or, like, upon normal people, like, danger, abnormalcy, whatever, descending, creeping in, seeping in, whatever. It's in a lot of his movies. This one, I think, is one of those that it's so fun when you're watching it to think about what you would do. I mean, I'm more than any other Hitchcock, I think that this could happen to me, where I'm just like, I meet a random and they're like, hey, joke, 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 let me kill your husband, joke, 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 and I laugh about it. And then the next day it happens. it's really scary. Like, it's a very scary thought to, you know, be like humoring a stranger and seeing that be taken for fact and seriousness. Like, I feel like I humor strangers every day. And if any of them ever thought that I was serious listening or whatever, they would be like, I would be living in a whole different world where my loved ones would be dead, I think. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, Bruno himself, the very first time that we meet him, we know that there's something off. And he says that line, oh, I just admire people who do things. Which is such a weird thing to say. But yeah, like you said, the fact that he knows, you know, about Guy's private life is really off-putting. And Guy's kind of like, okay, fella, like, it's nice that you recognized me, but that's a little too intimate. But, you know, Bruno won't give up. He's tenacious. And you know, I think Guy's ego gets the better of him in the beginning, but then he's like, oh no, what have I done? And we've all been in that situation where we, like you said, we humored a stranger, but now, oh, there might be something wrong with this stranger, and how do we get away from them?
Yeah, and there's no part of, I mean, let me ask you this. Is there any part of you that believes that Bruno sought him out, or that it was just happenstance?
I think he sought him out.
Okay. I do not ever think that with this movie. I actually think that it was complete happenstance, but I think that's illogical too, to believe that it just happened that way. So I would like to believe that he sought him out, but
I think Bruno sets it up like, oh, what are the odds that, you know, we are these strangers that meet totally randomly on this train, and we both have someone in our life that we would, you know, like to not have in our life anymore. What a crazy coincidence. But I don't think it is.
I guess. Yeah, no, I think that's so much easier to believe. But then, to me, it's more reinforced that there is no real, like, he doesn't go onto that train believing that he can make that deal. Because when you see him in public with other people, he'll like go up to someone and be like, I know who you are. You're this person. Now, what do you think about that? Like the party where he goes up to the judge, you know, and he's like, yeah. Hey, judge. It just feels like he knows everybody's, like, the surface of everybody's shit around there. But he's not even from that town, so I don't know. That doesn't make sense. But I also want to believe that he is just this weirdo that, like, memorizes the phone book and then goes deeper a few levels.
Yeah, I think he's intelligent, but he's got, I mean, for lack of a better term, he's got some screws loose. And he just, and he's also, like, ADD or something. I mean, he's just like his energy is like super scattered. So yeah, like he has all these plans and these plots and probably these conspiracies and stuff. So he's just like really, really scattered, and it's uncomfortable to deal with him. And could be that, I mean, I guess you could read it that it was completely random and he just ran with it. I just always thought that there was a plan in mind.
Yeah, I think it's so much more believable that there is a plan, and also adds such a layer to him that can be just taken away if there was no plan. But
even just the idea that even the plot to kill the president was probably just something he said off the top of his head, because Guy lives in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, I can just imagine that, you know, as he's putting together this plan, he just sort of randomly says this to his mother, you know, and I don't know.
Yeah, and even on the train, he makes just random comments like, I'll tell you about this idea someday, you know, and it is really like, also, I adore. When he gets closer to Guy, when they're sitting across from each other on the train, and then he comes and sits right next to Guy, and
yeah.
Guy kind of like, I don't know, kind of like shudders a little bit away from him, and he's like, don't worry, I don't talk much. You can go on reading. And
right.
You don't shut up, though. And, you know, that's, I think he is so good. That maybe like 4 months ago or something, when we were watching something else and there was a reference to Strangers on a Train, we were like, oh, that would be so fun to revisit. I watched maybe the first 15 minutes of it and could not take Bruno. Like, I was like, I cannot take you. Like, I was just in a mood where like I couldn't deal with him because he is so much, but he is so good.
I get that. I tried to watch The Fisher King again when I was trying to figure out something. I think when we were doing a lot of Quinnisodes before. And same thing. I got like 10 minutes in and I could not take Jeff Bridges' character because he's such a fucking asshole. And here, I mean, the energy is really frenetic and it's a lot. And so I understand that completely, but I think it's that scene after there's a couple of things going on in that scene. One, I think Hitchcock and Highsmith wanted to suggest that Bruno is gay and that he is, you know, he has maybe a lot of different kinds of interests in Guy. So the moving closer to Guy, I think, is suggestive of that. But I think this is the shot too, where there are blinds and the shadows are reflected on Bruno's face, not on Guy's face, but there are lines that are going through, shadows that are going through Bruno's face, which, you know, there are a lot of shots of him like behind grating.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of like bars that separate the two men. So I think part of what's going on is there's a lot of comparison to the two men. But then there's also, you know, showing the differences between them and how much Bruno is really trapped, you know, in his, I don't know, mind, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's what makes him so dangerous.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous shadows in this one. Like, again, oh my God. Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about his films and the reasons that it took him a while to get to using color. And I mean, so much of that is this skill that he honed so masterfully with the shadows and the lighting and what that is doing so successfully. in this film. And the shots, the cinematography, like you said, you know, the Dutch angles everywhere, but not overstated necessarily, but they do become a little in your face. I think near, at least once you get to the end, it's like, this is a little bit too much of those Dutch angles. They are gorgeous, and they do exactly what they're supposed to do. Did you think there were too many?
Yeah, I think it goes a little bit. I think it gets a little bit mad toward the ending, but you know, the first one I think we see is when Guy is going inside his house. He gets out of his cab and he goes up the stairs, and then there's a cant, and that's when Bruno calls him from across the street. And you know, of course, Guy has no expectation that he would ever see this weirdo ever again. And here he is. He's like, "What are you doing here?" You know, and that's when he gives him the glasses.
Yeah, which were Miriam's glasses. And of course, they're very, very thick. And you talked about the lens shot when he murders her. You can see you're looking through her glasses on the ground. You're looking up at him strangling her. Yeah. What a tramp.
And those glasses are also really important for Patricia Hitchcock's character, because she also wears thick glasses.
Yeah.
And let's just talk about Patricia Hitchcock.
Okay. Yeah. Deal.
So she is the girlfriend's younger sister, and she lives with Anne and her dad, I guess, the senator, and is really into true crime.
Yeah. Like,
she's a murderino before there were murderinos.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my God, that's a great point. Yeah, she lives with Anne and her dad, and the first time that you see her, Anne is getting kind of like, it's the first time you see Anne and Guy together, and she's like, you know, they embrace, and she said, "My dad wants to talk to you." She brings him back into the study, and there is her dad and Babs, or Barbara, whatever, who is played by Patricia Hitchcock. And this is when they tell him that Miriam's been murdered. Of course, he knows this because he just came from this meeting with Bruno where, you know, he is told that Bruno tells him that he murdered him. And so it's time for him to do his part. But yeah, she's all about it. And I'm not sure how many times the dad has to pretty much tell her to calm down in that scene. It just gets so hilarious.
Well, and she's absolutely right. Of course he's going to be the prime suspect. And of course he's going to have to be really careful, you know, not to be seen with Anne in public now and things like this. Yeah, and the senator's like, okay, you know, okay, Barbara, why don't we... And I think it's just because the reality, he's understanding the implications of everything he's saying. He knows that she's telling the truth and that this is a very dangerous situation for them all to be in.
Yes. I love it when, you know, Guy says something about this drawing attention to the senator, and she's like, "Daddy doesn't care about that. He's a senator." So great.
She is so great. And then she also has a really wonderful scene with Bruno when Bruno, and this reminded me of that scene in Rope where Jimmy Stewart is talking to the old ladies about, like, maybe it would be nice to have, you know, murder be okay, like one day of the month or something like that. And the women are like, "Oh, yes, I just think that would be," you know, they're just so titillated by the conversation. And so there's another one of those conversations with Bruno and this old lady. And he's talking about how the perfect way to kill somebody is to strangle them with your hands. And he starts to demonstrate, and then he sees Barbara in her glasses looking at him, and then he flashes back to killing Miriam, and he's actually starting to strangle this old lady. And it's very scary for Barbara.
Yes. She later remarks that he was, you know, looking at her like he was murdering her. That woman also, yeah, she's really into the idea of casually talking about murder too. And that's, you know, like the last movies that we've done, the Hitchcock movies, there's so much casual discussion about murder that it's such a common theme and thread in these, like in Rope, Suspicion, Shadow of a Doubt, just this casual conversation where there seem to be these smaller characters within the film that are obsessed with murder, you know, in addition to whatever plot is taking place, they seem to be like on their own little, you know, and it's just, I think, reflective of him and his obsession mm-hmm. and, you know, and also like the casualness of it all, making something that is so abnormal and so hush hush, putting it out into like a social conversation and having these people be like, oh yes. And I actually think it would be the perfect murder if you burn somebody alive in the middle of the road, you know, or whatever. And it's, yeah. It makes you like these characters feel more real because we talk about that stuff, but like also that is not usual for a 1950s film or any of these that he did, like to have this sort of comedic discussion like that. That's not something that was done.
Yeah, I really love it. And I know that in Shadow of a Doubt, it's men who are talking about the perfect murder, but I like it in these other examples where it's like women who, you know,
smart,
take care with their appearance and they're part of society and, you know, underneath it all, you know, they love to talk about the yeah. perfect murder.
You know, and like, if you look at this movie too, and you just think about the way that, you know, we know the way that Hitchcock treats women in film, and we know the history behind that. But some of these films are also highlighting the fact that he also believes that women are the smartest characters in the room, the smartest people in the room. Because the smartest person in this film is Patricia Hitchcock's Babs. She, like, has it all figured out, and she's the one that's also going to risk herself, you know, and do things and take action. It's not Anne doing these things, it's Barbara. You know, it certainly isn't Guy doing these things, it's Barbara.
Yeah, for sure. I love that, too. And I'm just, like, becoming such a huge fan of Patricia Hitchcock watching these movies. I mean, she's just so great. And I think this movie would be a much lesser movie if her character were not in it.
Oh my God, yes. I love her so much in Psycho, but we only get like 2 or 3 minutes of her. And in this, it's just such a joy to watch her because she really is good. And I wish she would have been in more.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about was the sequence at the carnival where Bruno is following Miriam. Oh, it's so good. Like, all we really know about Miriam is she is a tramp. She's married. She has a boyfriend who's gotten her pregnant. And now she's out with 3 other boys. And and Bruno has decided that he's going to kill her. But she doesn't know that. She thinks that he's just flirting with her. And it's so scary and so, when she actually is murdered, it's just so shocking because up to this point, you know, there's been this sort of playful interaction between the two. And like I told you before, I just love the part when he waggles his eyebrows at her after he's done the strongman, you know, game and displayed his, virility or something. And he just really obviously like wants her to pay attention to him.
Yeah, that scene is so great. That eye move is the creepiest shit I've ever seen. I love it. I also would like to pop a child's balloon with a cigarette. That would
be fun. Yes. That would be wonderful.
And it's just like, it's such a, I love that he does that. It's such a weird thing that Bruno would do. But also the other side of that is that he's like trying not to draw attention to himself. And yet he pops a fucking balloon with a cigarette, you know, and the kid's like, what the hell? It's just so not like it doesn't coincide with his action or with his intended action. It's so hilarious and weird.
I think the kid just sort of gets in his way. I mean, he's got a mission. He's like a shark, you know, he's just like trying to fulfill his mission. And the kid is like, hey, mister. And he's just like, what the fuck you? Like, you're in my way. And also, I think it's a great demonstration of what a psycho this guy is. I mean, that's like, you know, out of pocket, you know?
Yeah, I also like it when they are in the tunnel of love on the boats, and it's Miriam and the three guys, or the two guys in one boat, and then behind them is Bruno. And once they get on the boat, you start hearing the band played on that song, and Miriam and the guys start singing it like in sing-song like motion, and then all of a sudden you see Bruno also singing it in his own boat. And I also feel like that is super creepy and indicative of who he is, which is like such a weird character that he was getting into this as well, even though he had this, you know, plan in front of him to kill this woman. And I don't believe about this movie. I mean, I love the scene where he's, you know, showing the woman how he would strangle somebody, which he's already done at the party. And then he sees Babs and he's like taken back. But the thing I don't believe about it is that this is his first murder. Like, in no way, shape, or form do I believe that Miriam is his first murder.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about that. But, I mean, you're right. If it is, you can tell that he's put like so much thought into, like, I don't know, just the timing is just so perfect when he takes his moment to kill her. And it's a movie, so fortunately it only takes, what, 45 seconds to kill somebody?
Yeah.
I mean, actually, this always bothers me in movies, except for like No Country for Old Men or something, but it takes, I think, 7 minutes to strangle somebody. So, you know, it's never accurate, but I mean, at least in No Country for Old Men, it's, you know, it's maybe a little more accurate.
Yeah.
But,
and Inglourious Bastards, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah. But in general, it's like this, you know, squeeze, and the person is dead. And then he's able to slip back through the crowd, and Miriam's body isn't discovered for maybe another minute. So that gives him time to slip away. And so, I mean, I think he must have known every inch of that carnival and known, you know, tried to make a plan about, you know, when and where he could actually kill her.
Yeah, that's funny to think about him knowing every inch of the carnival. That just adds like a little layer to him. I love it too that he draws a map of his house of where his dad's bed is.
Yeah, so that's also in the book. The Great Dane is not in the book. And actually, in the book, Guy does kill the father.
Yes. I haven't read the book, but I knew that difference in it. I've not read it, though.
But also, Bruno's death in the book is so kind of, like, abrupt. He falls off a boat. He falls off the back of a boat. And that's it for Bruno. Oh. And there's, like, still a whole lot of book left. So I think they make really good companions to each other. And I think as written, he is just like, Bruno is such a wacky character. And I'm just amazed that, you know, this actor was able to pull that off.
Yeah. And I do adore that in the end when he is caught under the carousel, and that's how he dies. That guy's like, tell him that you killed Miriam. And he's like, I'm afraid I can't help you, guy. It's just like, even at the end, he won't, you know, even though they're going to know in a second when he opens his hand that he's got the lighter, which is everything in this movie. You know, it's his MacGuffin that we're following. Although I think it could be argued that it really does mean it is important. It's more than, I think it's more than a MacGuffin, but yeah, even till the end, I can't help you, guy. You're the one that did that. You know, I don't know. It's just, I salute this man. I would have loved to see what he did, because I am blown away by this performance. And I don't feel like this wasn't one, again, this isn't not a Hitchcock movie that like I used to go to, or that was like, you know, more of a comfort film than other Hitchcock movies. This wasn't one of those for me. And I don't think that I ever thought his performance was particularly, you know, this great until this watch. So I'm thankful to have revisited this one, because it was one I had seen and one I was like, that was really good plot wise, but I didn't think that much of it. And now I do, I think a lot more of it. And so much of it is really due to Bruno's performance.
Yeah. I think it might be my favorite.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what would
you love it.
Can I ask what you would do if this happened to you? If someone like killed somebody that you...
Oh my God. I don't... Oh man. Oh, well, I'd tell you, of course, like immediately. And then we'd have to hatch a plan to figure out what to do. I mean, oh my Lord.
I'm afraid that...
How terrifying.
I know.
I think it would happen to you before it would happen to me.
I'm afraid that if it did happen to you, that I would be like, we have to hide this. We have to deal with this. We cannot go to the police. I don't know why. I think I would say that, though. That would be my first instinct.
Oh. I know. At first I was like, well, obviously I'd go to the police. But... man, wow. That would be, it really, you know, shows you that you got to watch what you say, you know, around people.
I think so. More than anything, I feel like this really could happen. And it does scare me a lot. because it's so unbelievable, but it's not. Like, if you were to actually go to the police, if Guy were to have gone to the police, now, these police, I believe they would have been like, okay, makes sense. But now, I don't think that they would. And I don't know. Unbelievable.
I mean, it probably depends on what city we lived in when these events took place. You know, like how much did the police have on their dockets and stuff. But these police officers are not great in the movie. You know, they're...
They are terrible.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. Fortunately, I don't think I have anybody obviously in my life that, you know, if they were to pass from this mortal coil, that people would suspect me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not in the position that Guy's in.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a tough place for him to be in. He doesn't love his wife. She's pregnant by another man and she refuses to give him a divorce.
She really is a not great human. I mean, we don't see that much of her. When she's at the carnival with those other guys, she's fine. But like, she has this conversation with Guy before that where she's saying, yeah, I did want a divorce. Now I don't. You're going to pay for this. You're going to pay money from your rich little tennis friends. And she's pretty scary. She's threatening, you know, and she could probably make it so because, you know, she is the woman who is pregnant and she will have this child. And, you know, I don't know, like, she is not great. And, yeah, I don't know. Just in that scene, I think you have a pretty good understanding of her. Although that is a scene in which she's dealing with an ex and there is, you know, a past. So that may not be her necessarily, but certainly is her in that.
Yeah, the way she's presented, I mean, she seems pretty manipulative and she seems pretty, I don't know what I want to say, scheming. because yeah. from the outside, it looks like Guy is the aggressor in the conversation from the outside. But from what we see, obviously, she's needling him and she's saying that, no, I'm not going to give you a divorce. You're not going to be able to be with the woman you love. And you're going to have to support me and this baby that's not yours. Because that's the way it is, Guy. And so she really puts him in a spot.
Yeah.
Not a good representation of women.
No, not
in her, you know, in Barbara. Yes. And in Anne, well, Anne,
Bland.
She's just there.
Bland Anne.
Bland Anne. Bland.
Anne ain't no Barbara.
And the bland. No, she sure ain't.
Straight. Oh, I love right, the senator in this, Leo Carroll.
Oh, me too. Leo G. Carroll. Oh, what a dream.
Yeah, and it's so fun to watch him reprimand Barbara as well. And, you know, all throughout the movie. And like, you can just tell that she's a handful and has always been. And that's amazing. But it is funny to watch him, you know, be like, calm down, Barbara. All right, Barbara, that's enough, Barbara. Barbara, go get us Sherry. You know, like, so great.
Yeah, and now she's at an age where she can't really be silenced. You know, she's becoming a strong woman. And I don't know. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It would be interesting to think about their relationship, you know, after this movie. But okay. Yeah, it must have been fun.
Yeah. And I.
All right, cue balls. Here's some trivia. Cytochromophobia, which we've had before, is the fear of trains. Some posters showed Sir Alfred Hitchcock inserting the letter L into the word strangers in the title to make stranglers. The stunt where the man crawled under the carousel was not done with trick photography. Sir Alfred Hitchcock claimed that this was the most dangerous stunt ever performed under his direction, and he would never allow it to be done again. Oh, I thought this was interesting. You probably knew this piece of trivia before, but I did not. In the scene where Ruth Roman and Patricia Hitchcock are watching the tennis match, Ruth gives Patricia a real U.S. $10 bill. Showing real U.S. money in movies, then, was illegal without permission from the U.S. Treasury Department. The Treasury Department later removed the prohibition for Psycho 1960 and later movies. Did you know that?
No, I actually did not know that about money. That is so weird, but I'm not surprised.
Why?
Maybe because if you're showing it, maybe they're like, well, people can reproduce it if they see it, but it's like, couldn't they see it in real life? Wouldn't they have an opportunity to? So I'm not really sure. I don't know. Cause a lot of the production code stuff was done because people didn't trust the general, you know, masses to control themselves.
Maybe it would just like inflame people too much to see that filthy lucre. As was his, I love this fact about Alfred Hitchcock, actually. I don't know how I feel about him, but I love this fact. As was his usual practice, Sir Alfred Hitchcock shot each scene so that there was only one way to edit it, which always conformed to his initial visual concept and pre-production storyboards. That's great.
Yeah.
That's giving it to the man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
To achieve the shot of Bruno Robert Walker murdering Miriam, Casey Rogers, reflected in the glasses, an enormous distorting lens was constructed. Walker and Rogers were then reflected in it at a 90-degree angle.
That's such a gorgeous shot. Such a gorgeous shot.
In 2021, the same year Patricia Hitchcock died, R.I.P., the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress for being, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. I would say all three.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, you want to do the Letterboxd?
Yeah. All right, so I'll start with 5-star reviews. This is Darren Carver Hoff Singer. 5-star. Strangers on a Train is a humorous thriller being really enjoyable through its dark irony. Hitchcock delivers as expected with some beautiful aesthetics, a tense final act, and some gleeful perversity. The story is one of murder, but thematically ends up a story of lives doubled. There's not much more to say. Strangers on a Train is just a slick and enjoyable ride. It may not be peak Hitchcock, but it's damn good.
It's peak Hitchcock.
I would say it is peak Hitchcock as well, because he was so, some of his films that I love so much are not super funny. And this, he was so funny. And so there has to be humor if you're talking peak Hitchcock. And the cinematography is so on point and gorgeous and so powerful. So I would say yes, it totally is. And plus, a lot of his themes that he loved to grapple with are all here. So, like, what are you looking for, Darren? What do you think is peak Hitchcock, Darren? Not mad at you, but, you know. Okay. This is Kyle Marshall. He says, wow, a great use of tension with a smattering of comedy. I would argue there's even some gay subtext. Oh, really, Kyle?
You would argue that, Kyle?
Oh. The performances are great. The climax is ludicrous. There's an in-depth tennis match. A kid gets punched. What's not to like? I loved that.
I don't think a kid get. Does a kid get punched? Is it on the carousel? The kid almost falls off the carousel.
Yes, the little boy. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And Guy saves him. So that, like, you know, I think that really cements in our minds, you know, the difference between the two men. Guy is obviously, you know, a good guy.
The kid was punching Guy, you know, like helping Bruno punch Guy.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So then he says, got to see this as part of secret cinema where you buy a ticket and don't know what's being shown until seconds before showtime. Highly recommend. How cool is that?
Wow.
Love it. Okay. Kenneth C. says, a cigarette lighter, a pair of eyeglasses, a tennis match, a storm drain, a merry-go-round, a Hitchcock masterpiece. And you, Kenneth, are a poet. I love the storm drain. I dropped a lighter down there. Sir, it's gone. That scene is, it's just so good. And you just, like, stretch your arm with him, I feel like, or I did.
Yeah, yeah.
It is ridiculous, though, too. Ocean 20 says, this Hitchcock's little gem is a bit underappreciated, but this is probably one of the most influential films that shaped the form of modern thrillers. It has a smart and disturbed but still weirdly charming villain. Plot is simple but very effective. Tension is built slowly, which makes its bombastic climax feel earned. And by the way, Washington, D.C. as a setting is totally underused in movies.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. I don't know about D.C. being underused, but yeah, maybe. I just hadn't thought about it. All right, Sam Trevor writes, my fave Hitchcock. I don't know why this one isn't held in higher regard. I think a lot of Hitchcock movies suffer from a slow buildup, but this one doesn't waste a second. Every single scene is suspenseful, and Robert Walker is so goddamn scary with his every movement, impeccable performance. Plot goes crazy, and on top of all of it, it's got some of the most beautiful shots. The chiaroscuro lighting, or the chiaroscuro of the fair scenes is insane. Love this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's one shot in the beginning when Bruno is following Miriam, and it's an iconic shot. And he looks like so handsome. He's got a hat on his head, and he just looks so intriguing. And it's like, how do you shoot a guy being intriguing? But they did it.
Yeah. Oh, just lighting is so, so powerful. I don't know. I feel obsessed with lighting. And it's really,
yeah.
You can't understand it until you watch black and white movies and you see the light and the dark and the mix and the chiaroscuro lighting, and that art form is so gorgeous in these films, and film noir films especially. which I think this is considered one as well.
Yeah, I would say so.
Maybe not having all the factors, but all right. So that's it for the 5-star reviews.
Okay, Tony Zhao gave it a 0.5-star. Too many shots of people talking. Bad, bad, bad. Evie Martha gave it 1-star. Completely different from the book. Just cuts corners, so I was very disappointed with it.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, that's the classic, you know, conversation about which is better. And I think they're both, you know, great pieces of art.
Yeah, I need to read the book.
There's a lot more that goes on in the book. But like I said, I mean, some of it I think is a little bit tedious. I think Anne, her belief in her man is just kind of hard to swallow.
Is Bruno as, like, sort of creepy and funny?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I have a feeling that there might be some dog barking.
Okay. Carolyn Sluice gave it 1.5 stars. Not gonna lie, had no idea what was going on while watching this. I had a cold, and my head was so heavy, but I had to take a quiz on it for my class. Ended up getting a 64%. Anyways, the lesson here, kids, is don't take a quiz last minute while you have a cold, because you will not know anything. Might try to rewatch this when I'm not laying on my deathbed.
Oh, Caroline, I guess everything's just about you and your cold. It is about the movie.
That's the best.
That is really good.
Caroline, I love you. I just want to read all your reviews now.
I want them all to be about your self-centered world.
Gigi Bell gave it 1.5 stars. Serious question. What's the Percy Jackson book where they ride the abandoned tunnel of love? I need to know. It's killing me.
1.5 stars. Oh, honey. Weirdo.
I love Letterboxd. Oh, Valerie gave it 1 star. Ass.
What?
So, would you recommend this film, Quinn?
Yeah. Without reservation, I would recommend this to anyone who loves a good film.
Me too. Would we watch it again?
I probably will tomorrow.
Heck yeah. It's very watchable. I mean, I don't know. I just think it's a great film.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's, I don't know. I do think it's underrated as well. So yeah, I would definitely recommend it to anyone, even my mother, Karen.
Hi, Karen. Hey, Mom. She doesn't listen to the podcast. Well, thank you so much, Quinn, for talking with me about Strangers on a Train. Thank you, Wohos and Q-Balls, for joining us for the special edition Quinnisode. Next time on the Quinnisode, Quinny and I will be looking at Gaslight from 1944. Next time on the main show, Mac and I will be looking at slasher movies. We will be reviewing You're Next from the U.S. and Tenebrae from Italy. We would love it if you subscribed and left us a nifty 5-star rating, but we'd be just as happy if you just told all your friends all about us. On that, a shout out to Wohos in various area codes. Our last Quinnisode was downloaded in the U.S., Germany, Canada, Brazil, and the U.K. If you would like a specific shout out, please get in touch. Remember, Q-Balls, we love you, and don't go into the basement.